And in a class with Alistair McIntyre at Notre Dame, he told me that he liked his work because it was inside work with no heavy lifting. And that's true. But there's deeper reasons to appreciate being a Catholic intellectual. So what I'm going to be talking about basically are three different aspects. So first, what I'll call some remote preparation. And secondly, what I'll call finding a vocation to the intellectual life. And then thirdly, embracing the vocation to the intellectual life. So my own vocation to the intellectual life started very early. I was in fourth grade, and I was with a friend named Kenan McDonald. He was the sixth of six children. And somehow we got talking, and all of a sudden the subject of abortion came up. And he took the pro-choice side, and I took the pro-life side. And he said to me, "So hold on, you're telling me that you think one single cell is a human being equal to you or me?" And I thought, well, no, I mean, not one cell. I mean, no, you're right, okay, not one cell. And he goes, "Well, how about two cells, or three cells, or five? Is there, you tell me, that's equal to you or me?" And I thought, well, I guess not. And he goes, "Well, that's why I'm pro-choice, right? Just a handful of cells don't really have value or dignity." And so it started me to wonder. And I thought, God, I don't know how to answer that. That's really puzzling to me. And then that summer, I went to summer camp, Camp Norwester, up in Lopez Island. And up at the camp, I went into the bathroom, and as you know, in many camp bathrooms, there's graffiti all over the walls. And I looked at the graffiti, and then there was a question there. And the question was, can God make a rock he can't lift? And I thought, can God make a rock? And then, I thought, God can do everything. Right? God's omnipotent, so of course he can make a rock he can't lift. But then I thought, well, hold it, if there's a rock God can't lift, well, then the rock is greater than God in some way. And isn't God that than which nothing greater can be conceived? So if I answered yes, the answer seemed wrong. If I answered no, the answer seemed wrong. Both answers seemed wrong. Both the answers seemed right. I didn't know what to think. I was totally mystified. Fourth grade was a big year for me. Also in fourth grade, I did something I wasn't supposed to do. My parents told me not to go up into the attic. So of course, when they were gone, I went up to the attic. And I was searching around the attic, and I came across this box of books. And it was the books from my mom in college. So I'm looking through all these books, and I run across a book, Introduction to Aquinas. And I was like, great, okay, I'll check this out. So I open it up. Very first page, it says, "Is theology a science?" Okay, is theology a science? That sounds interesting. So I started reading, and I had the most bizarre experience. I could understand every single word individually, but when you put all the words together in a sentence, I had no clue what it meant. And I thought, who is this Thomas Aquinas guy? This is completely mysterious to me. I don't understand. This is really weird. So anyway, that book, I couldn't make heads or tails of. I read about two pages, and I just gave up. But then I came across another book, and it was called I Teach Catechism. And it was a book that people use if they're teaching catechism. And I was reading through that, and it had this passage about all the great minds in the history of our church. You know, Origen, Augustine, Aquinas, Bonaventure, John Henry Newman. And it said that if all these great minds could be happy as Catholics, with all the intellectual puzzles that they attacked and looked after, then you can too. And I thought to myself, well, there's something profoundly true about that, because if there's one thing I know about myself, it's that I'm not as wise as Augustine, Aquinas, John Henry Newman, Origen, etc. So if they could be happy as Catholics and have their minds satisfied, well, certainly I thought I could do that too. It was only later that I read this quotation from John Henry Newman, where he said that 10,000 difficulties do not make a doubt. Now, what does that mean? Well, immediately after he says that, he talks about mathematics. And you may have had the experience before where you're doing a math problem, and you know that there is a correct answer, but you just can't, in the moment, figure out the correct answer. Or you might have the correct answer, but you don't know how to correctly work out the solution to the problem, right? So we've all had this situation where we've had a difficulty, we've had a question, we've had a mystery, and we at the moment given our own intellectual resources, just weren't sure how to solve the question, how to get rid of the mystery, how to figure out what the answer or the solution really is. And that will be true for us as believers, but it's also true for atheists, because atheists have difficulties. Atheists have challenges to their view. And it's also true in felt subjective certainty about belief. So what I mean is, C.S. Lewis has this great passage where he says, when I was an atheist, I had moments where I'd look at the beauty of the world, for instance, and I'd say to myself as an atheist, maybe I'm wrong, right? Maybe there is a God. And Lewis continued, now as a theist, there are times where he looks around at the world and sees things and experiences things and says, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not sure. So to be human, at least to be an intellectual human, is to have questions. It is to have difficulties. It is to have things that you're just not sure about. But none of that gets in the way of the Catholic intellectual life. In fact, all of that is something that serves to move us forward in the intellectual life. So when you have doubts about this issue or that issue, when you're puzzled about why the church teaches this or that about whatever, that's all right. Explore that. Investigate that. See what Augustine has to say about that. See what Aquinas has to say about that. See what Joseph Ratzinger has to say about that, Pope Benedict XVI, or Pope Francis. Questions and doubts and worries and difficulties, you might say, are all impetus that can move us forward in the intellectual life. Sometimes people think of a Catholic intellectual as sort of a contradiction in terms, right? Like a ejection seat on a helicopter, or a screen door in a submarine, right? Something that just doesn't even make sense. But in fact, Aquinas pointed out that faith inflames the mind, giving rise to new questions. The idea that having faith shuts down questioning is just the opposite of the case. In fact, it's when you have faith that a whole new realm of questions opens up, right? If you believe that God exists, well, then you can ask questions about, well, how does God interact with the world? How is it possible that human beings are free and God is free? If you have questions about, if you believe, rather, that Jesus is truly God and truly a human being, well, then you can begin to ask questions about, well, does the child Jesus know when he's 10 that he's going to suffer, die, and then rise from the dead on the third day? So when you have faith, that gives rise to questions and open questions, and it draws us to want deeper understanding. So it's not shutting down the mind in any way. The next stage of my intellectual vocation, you might say, was going to college. So I went to Boston College, and that's really where I'd say I found my intellectual vocation. And I'd say it started in the honors program at Boston College. We were reading the great books, right? Homer, Aristophanes, we read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, a book that really struck me, because for the first time I really saw how meaningful and important philosophy is. Aristotle, as you may remember, talks about the different kinds of friends, right? He talks about friends of utility, friends of pleasure, friends of virtue. And immediately when I read that passage, I thought about my own friends. And I tried to say, well, you know, what kind of friends do I have? Are these friends of pleasure, friends of utility, friends of virtue? And I was honest enough to admit to myself that they were almost all friends of pleasure. And that taught me something really important about myself. I read Augustine's Confessions, and that too is a very important work for me. Because Augustine taught in the Confessions that our lives are a journey. Our lives are kind of an adventure, a pilgrimage. And we hopefully are heading to the city of God, but maybe we're not. Maybe we're heading to the city of man to talk about another of Augustine's works. Anyway, one of the key moments, though, was the guy I met next door. His name is Chad Roper. And Chad was also in the honors program. And so Chad and I had countless hours of conversations. And Chad saw everything differently than I did. He was pro-choice. I was pro-life, so we argued about that. He argued as an atheist, so I argued in favor of God. And then when he got tired of that, he argued as a Protestant, so I argued against him as a Catholic. So we argued and argued and went back and forth and back and forth. And Chad is a really smart guy, and he's a really nice guy. And it taught me something super important, I think, about the intellectual life. And that is, when you have disagreements with someone, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a bad person. When you have disagreements with someone, it doesn't mean that you can't be friends with them. In fact, Chad and I were best friends. We were roommates together in two different years in college. He was the best man at my wedding. I was the best man at his wedding. And I just saw him just a few days ago for his 50th birthday. So be friends with people that see things differently than you do. Think about Robert George and Cornel West. As you probably know, they're not exactly on the same page politically. And yet, they're great friends because they have something in common that's absolutely essential for any kind of intellectual, and that is to seek the truth, to speak the truth as you understand it, and to live the truth. That's really what the intellectual life is about. So what's distinctive then about a Catholic intellectual? Well, as Catholics, we believe that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And as Catholics, we believe the Church, as Scripture says, is the pillar and foundation of truth. So Catholic intellectuals, like all intellectuals, are trying to seek the truth. But we have a decisive advantage because of our understanding of Jesus and our understanding also of the Church. And when I was arguing with Chad for many hours and hours and hours about different issues, I finally came to an answer to the question that had haunted me from fourth grade, right? Can you really believe that a single cell is a human being? And I realized at that point that we have no trouble at all with admitting that there are single-celled organisms, right? Everybody admits that there's amoebas and all kinds of single-celled creatures. So that's not a problem. So then the question is, well, is this zygote, which is a living creature of some kind, is it a human being or not? And this, of course, is a question that can be answered scientifically. So if you think about it from a scientific perspective, and you're trying to determine the species of a bunch of different single-celled organisms, you could look at questions like, well, are the parents of this organism human beings? Did this organism arise from a human father and a human mother? Is this organism an organism that has human DNA? Is it on a human trajectory of growth? Whenever you answer all these questions, it becomes crystal clear from a scientific perspective that the single-celled organism, the human zygote, is, in fact, a human being. And then the question arises, well, should we respect and protect all human beings or just some? If you look at the history of thought, there are many different times and places where people have said, well, you don't need to respect all human beings. You only need to respect human beings like me or like us, the in-group, right? So if you have the right skin color, then you deserve respect. But if you have the wrong skin color, then we can enslave you. If you're the right sex, you deserve respect. If you're female, well, you don't really deserve respect. Right? If you're the right religion, you deserve respect. But if you're a different religion, well, then you don't really count as being within the human community. And so the science of it is actually crystal clear. There's actually a recent survey of biologists. And more than 96% of biologists said that human life begins at conception. So when you talk about science denial, right? Sometimes people like to throw that in the face of people of faith. Oh, you're a science denier. Well, do those people deny the consensus of 96% of biologists that human life begins at conception? And then do they deny the consensus, hopefully in our country, that all men are created equal? And you might say, oh, that terrible Jefferson wrote all men. That means all males. No, it does not. If you look into Jefferson's own writings and other things he wrote, when he talks about all men being created equal, he doesn't mean all males. He doesn't mean all adult, landholding, rich Protestant males. He means all human beings. If you look at his other correspondence, he talks about Native Americans, he talks about African Americans, he talks about women. It's crystal clear from what he's wrote in other writings that by all men, he's using men in the inclusive sense, just like we do today sometimes. Like if I tell all of you, don't go out in the woods. There's a man-eating bear out there. And then would any of the women here be like, cool, I'm all set. No problem, I'm going to go out there and I'm totally immune. Of course not, right? You know, a man-eating lion or a man-eating bear is going to eat you as well as me. So Chad helped me a lot. Another person who helped me a lot was Peter Kraft. And he was really a living mentor. And if you want to be a Catholic intellectual, I would strongly encourage you to find not only friends that you can talk to, not only friends you disagree with, but also a living mentor, and Peter Kraft was mine. I walked into his class thinking about religion, and very first day, he got to the board, And he wrote on the board, either God exists or God does not exist. And I thought about it, and I thought, yeah, that's right. Either there really is a God, right? All powerful, all good, etc., etc. Or there really is, in reality, no such thing as God. All right. And then he wrote on the board, either Jesus really is God, or he is not. Yeah, that's right too, right? Either was who he said he was, he really is divine, he really can forgive sins, he really did rise from the dead, or maybe he's just a mere man, like you or me. And then he wrote on the board, either the Catholic Church really is the church, founded by Jesus and guided by the Holy Spirit, or it's not. And again, I thought, yeah, that seems right. So when he asked those questions, it was almost like a religious fog that I had been wandering in for years and years just sort of evaporated. I really understood for the first time that there really is truth out there. Now, it's a different question. Well, what is true? And then we have to talk about that, right? Does God exist? What are the best arguments for that? What are the best arguments against that? Is Jesus truly God? Again, we can talk about that. Is the Catholic Church really the church founded by Jesus and guided by the Holy Spirit even unto today? Well, we can talk about that. But it gave me those options. And after his course, and after reading a number of books that he had written and C.S. Lewis had written and others had written, I came to the conviction that in fact, God did exist. That in fact, Jesus really was truly God. That in fact, the church Jesus founded was the Holy Roman Catholic Church. And at that point, somebody else entered the picture, a guy named Dwight Duncan. Dwight is a law professor in Massachusetts. And he gave me a little tract by a guy named John Henry Newman. And I don't think at that point I'd ever heard of Newman before. And the tract was called Ventures in Faith. And in this tract, it basically says, what difference would it make for your life if you found out definitively that Christianity was wrong? And that could happen. It would be possible to prove definitively that Roman Catholicism is wrong. How would you do that? Well, let's say you found the body of the mother of Jesus. You found the body of Mary, right? And she didn't assume bodily into heaven, right? Here's her body. It's rotting right here. If she wasn't assumed bodily into heaven, well, then the dogma of the assumption is wrong. If the dogma of the assumption is wrong, well, then there's no papal infallibility. And if papal infallibility is wrong, then the current teaching of the Catholic Church is wrong. The church can't be relied upon. And if you found the body of Jesus, same thing about Catholicism, but about Christianity. So what difference would it make to your life or to my life if it were definitively disproved? And if your answer is, it wouldn't make any difference at all. I would just continue on my life and do everything I do now, and that would be it. Well, then you haven't made a venture in faith. A venture in faith is when you do something that only makes sense on the supposition of the truth of the gospel. It could be things you read, things you write. It could be time spent in prayer. It could be money spent on important projects. But the idea is something you would do on the supposition that the gospel is true, that you wouldn't do otherwise. Right? I assume you'd eat breakfast, whether the gospel were true or not. There's a lot of things we would do regardless of the truth of the gospel. But when I read Newman's thing, I asked myself, well, what am I doing? And I have to confess that I wasn't doing too much. But my friend Dwight, who was a kind of spiritual director for me, had lots of good suggestions. He said, well, if you want to do something that manifests your faith in the gospel, that is a venture of faith, something you would not do otherwise, he said, well, why don't you try going to Mass each day, not just on Sundays? Okay. He said, why don't you try going to confession once a week? Okay. A little later, a few months later, he said, well, why don't you try maybe saying the rosary every day? Oh, okay. A little bit later, This wasn't all in one day. It would have been a little overwhelming, like, oh my God, Dwight, lay off, man, this is killing me. But over the course of, you know, weeks and months, you know, he suggested various spiritual practices. Because to be a Catholic intellectual, it's essential that we have a deep spiritual life, that we nurture that. Because a Catholic intellectual is someone who's related to Jesus Christ. And you can't have a deep relationship with anyone, a friend, a family member, or Jesus, without communication with that person. And that's what prayer is communication with God. And so time of prayer is absolutely essential. And in reading another book by Peter Kreeft, he mentioned 15 minutes a day, to start with at least, to dedicate every day 15 minutes solely and exclusively to prayer, personal prayer with God. Now, how do you do that? Well, there's lots of different ways to pray. But that recommendation by Peter Kreeft about 15 minutes and Dwight Duncan made a big difference for me, all his suggestions. Now, when you talk about a vocation, there's really three senses of the term, and I'm drawing here on the late theologian Germaine Grisez. He talked about vocation as a universal call. And what that is the call to every human being on planet Earth to love God and to love neighbor. And that's totally universal. That's for everybody. Then there's vocation as a state in life. And that would be, say, for me to be a married person, for father to be a priest, for some people to be single. The idea is that your state in life is one sense of vocation, the second sense. And then the third sense is personal vocation. And that is completely unique to each person. So the personal vocation of Mary was to be the mother of Jesus and the husband of Joseph. And that is only her vocation. It's not your vocation, it's not your vocation, it's not my vocation. Only Mary's vocation is to be the mother of Jesus and the husband of Joseph. My vocation is to be married to Jennifer Turner Kayser, to be the father of my kids. That's what God called me to do, and he didn't call anyone else to do that, just me and me alone. So if I do a bad job at that, then the job just isn't done right. There's no substituting. There's no one else that can pinch it for my personal vocation. But the same thing's true for each of you. I don't know what your personal vocation is, but that is part of what we try to figure out in prayer. To ask God seriously, repeatedly, earnestly and openly, what do you want me to do? And let me suggest to you something that I used to pray in college a lot to help discern vocational issues. And personal vocation, I should say, continues indefinitely. So it's not just done, right? So I got married on January 4th, 1992, and so that's when I got married. But my personal vocation is ongoing, right? So I'm not, you know, trying to discern whether I should be married. That's done. But I am trying to discern how best to use my life. Every day you have another 24 hours, and every day you get to choose how you use that life. And so personal vocation is about asking God, well, what serves your purposes, your highest and best for me here and now in my life, given my circumstances, given, you know, my situation? So you can obviously pray just using your own words, but let me suggest maybe also using the words of John Henry Newman. Lead kindly life, lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home, lead thou me on. Keep thou my feet, I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me. It's a beautiful prayer. And that's all we need. I didn't even know my personal vocation 20 years from now. What does God want me to do then? I'm not even sure I'll be alive. Who knows what I'll be doing? But today, one step, move forward in a positive way, that I need. And that God can give each of us. So at the end of Boston College, as things ended, I was thinking, well, what do I want to do? And basically, I pretty much knew I wanted to have an intellectual life. I loved to read, I loved to write, I loved taking classes, I loved learning. I actually remember writing down as a senior in college different books that I wanted to write, And I should look back and see if I've written any of those books. Probably not. But anyway, at the time, I thought, oh, I'd like to write a book about this, a book about that. So I applied to 10 different graduate schools. And at the time, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to study philosophy or theology. So I applied to 10 different places, about half in each, and got into all of them, except for Notre Dame. And so I said, well, which one do I want to go to? I said, well, I'll study philosophy at the University of Toronto. So I was walking back from getting the mail, and I was walking back to my dorm. And for whatever reason, I said, well, I'm going to pray a Hail Mary about that and ask Mary to kind of guide me. So I did. And I got back to the dorm room, and I got a call from Notre Dame saying, we actually do have a place for you. Would you want to go to Notre Dame with a full scholarship and tuition remission? And I said, well, let me think about that for a second. And I did a little dance, and I said, yeah, that'd be great. I'll go for that. That sounds good. So off I went to Notre Dame. And when I got to Notre Dame, I experienced something that you may experience if you go to graduate school. And if you are in graduate school, you may already have experienced. And that's called the imposture syndrome. And it's basically where you think that you don't belong there. And I felt that very much. I felt at any minute they're going to say, oh, we made a mistake. I'm sorry, you know, you need to clear out your cubby and, you know, your desk and leave, and it was, you know, you don't belong here. And so I felt very insecure and nervous. And one of the reasons I was nervous is that in graduate school, at some point you need a dissertation director. And so I was looking around and I was trying to think, who can I have direct my dissertation? And I was to learn later that having a good relationship with your dissertation director is the number one factor determining whether or not you graduate and get your doctorate. So you know, it's a really important decision. So I was thinking of going with this one young professor at Notre Dame. And the rumor was that he was heading off to Yale. He was this kind of hotshot professor. And I thought, oh, I'll work with this person. But then I had a friend, Brian Kelly, who said, don't do that. This person's terrible, and they torpedo students, and you just can't work with so-and-so. So I said, well, I'm not sure how you work with. He said, well, why don't you work with the guy that I'm working with, Ralph McInerney? And I was like, Ralph McInerney, okay. And so Brian arranged for me to take a course with him called The Thought of Aquinas. And I'd never studied Aquinas before at all. I told you in fourth grade I had my, you know, 2 minutes fighting with the Summa, but I really hadn't studied Aquinas systematically at all up to that point. And at Boston College, I'd been assigned Karl Marx in three different core classes. So I was really very familiar with Karl Marx, but no Aquinas, zero. So I went to Ralph McInerney's course, and the course was for total beginners, people that had no experience with Aquinas. And as Ralph started to talk, Aquinas made more and more sense. Ralph McInerney passed away about 10 years ago, but he was an absolutely terrific guy. I would highly recommend his books, and he had a great sense of humor. He was about 68 when I met him, and he had already been teaching at Notre Dame about twice as long as I've been alive. So he'd been around forever, and he was just great. He had all these funny stories about Notre Dame, and he said things like, you know, I no longer buy green bananas. You know, he's concerned about dying that quickly. And he told me something that he wanted to say to someone who had many books that are all about the same topic, and he wanted to say to this professor, so I see you have a new book. What are you calling it this time? Right. So Ralph was great. He had a really good sense of humor. And he introduced me to Aquinas. So I had a dissertation director, and now I had also what I'll call a spiritual master. And I would strongly encourage all of you to find a spiritual master. Mine's Aquinas, but people have different temperaments and different dispositions. And so you might read Augustine, and you might say, man, Augustine is absolutely divine. He is terrific. I gain so much from reading Augustine. Or maybe Origen. Or maybe Bonaventure. I won't mention Scotus. Maybe John Henry Newman. Maybe Pope Benedict XVI or John Paul II. Edith Stein. Catherine of Siena. There are many deep, wonderful intellects in our tradition. And so find one that really resonates with you. And try to master the thought of your spiritual master. Now, that doesn't mean being a slave and always agreeing with everything that whoever you choose to really study in depth thinks. I think Aquinas is absolutely terrific, but I don't always agree with Aquinas. I think Aquinas was wrong about the Immaculate Conception. I think Aquinas was wrong about delayed humanization. I think Aquinas was wrong about how human reproduction works. I think Aquinas was right about almost everything else, though. Maybe not everything. But anyway, you get the idea. It's not as if you have to give up intellectual freedom. But it is really helpful to really understand at a really deep level the thought of some great thinker in our tradition. And again, there's many, many different options, so choose whichever one really resonates with you. It was in reading Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles that I came to an answer to that question that had puzzled me since fourth grade. Can God make a rock he can't lift? In Aquinas, I finally found the answer. So Aquinas says this, that God cannot do impossible things. So for instance, God can't give you free will and also not give you free will at the same time and in the same respect. Now, why can't God do this? Is it that God has a heavenly logic book that is governing him and he has to look at the logic book to make sure whether he can do something? No. No, the idea is if God chooses to give you free will, then God would contradict his own will if he also chose not to give you free will. So it would be God's will against God's own will. Now, we as human beings can do that, because our will can be fragmented and split. So part of me might want to be healthy, and part of me might want to smoke cigarettes still. But God, of course, is not divided within himself. God's not set in opposition to himself. Right? I can be my own worst enemy, but God is not his own worst enemy. So, can God make a rock he can't lift? No, he can't. Why? Because God can't do certain things. God can't do impossible things like give someone free will and not give someone free will. God can't kill himself. Right? There's things God can't do. And God can't make something greater than himself. Because nothing can be greater than God. That's a contradiction in terms. Here's another way to think about it. Can the author Shakespeare make a character in a play that's stronger than he is? Well, no. The author Shakespeare is working at an entirely different ontological level than any of the characters in the play that Shakespeare makes. And so too, God is working at a completely different ontological level than anything in creation. So God can't be in competition with or overcome by anything that's in his creation, just as Shakespeare can't really be in competition with or overcome by anything that's in one of his plays. So find an intellectual master. Find someone whose thought is so deep and so profound that it can occupy your thinking for decades. It could be Aquinas. St. John Paul II said, the church has been justified in consistently proposing St. Thomas as a model of thought and a model of the right way to do theology, he says in Fides et Ratio. So what are the takeaways? The takeaways of my talk today are fairly simple. If you want to be a Catholic intellectual, find a living mentor that can help you down the path. Find a spiritual director that can help you grow in faith. Find a spiritual master, some thinker that really resonates with you. And don't be afraid of your questions. Don't be afraid of things that are difficult for you. Don't be afraid of things that seem mysterious and hard. And I have to tell you honestly, there hasn't been one minute that I've regretted the choice to go into the intellectual life. I've absolutely loved it. If today I were to win a lottery and win $20 million, I would not quit my job. I love having the job that I have. I love being a professor. I love teaching students. I love writing things. I love giving talks. And maybe you're like me. And if you are, if God's inviting you to be a Catholic intellectual and dedicate your life to questions and to teaching and writing, then I expect that, like me, you'll find a life of deep happiness. Thank you very much.